here now for argument in June Depp versus Hicks. We're ready to hear from the petitioner.
Good morning. My name is Larry Hamill. I'm appearing on behalf of the appellant, Mr. and Mrs. Laundrie, Dr. and Mrs. Laundrie, excuse me, Dr. and Mrs. June Depp, and City Morton. As the court is well aware, three issues have been certified for the writ of certiorari in this case. The first issue is the one that we believe controls completely in this case, and that is whether or not the Court of Appeals' refusal to apply the doctrine of derivative subrogation, the right of the Laundries to convey to the June Depps their equitable subrogation rights by way of warranty deed, was improper, in that it improperly destroys an equitable interest in the rights of the Laundries, which has economic value and which must be respected.
You know, it took me a while to get to the maybe what the fundamental issue is here. And of course, I know you're going to address that, but the Laundries made a good deal of money on this transaction, yet the lien wasn't paid off. So, I mean, how is that in any sense equitable?
The Laundrie's profit in this transaction has nothing to do with the lien rights of Mr. Hicks. That whole argument about equity stripping completely ignores the fact that Mr. Hicks's interest in this property is only that of a lienor. He has no property interest in this property. He has no ownership, no equity in this interest in this property. If he wishes to foreclose his deed of trust, or his judgment lien more precisely, he's free to do so at any time. The idea that there was some sort of equity stripping by the June Depp, by the Laundries, is simply wrong. They owned the property. If there was that kind of equity in the property, Mr. Hicks could very easily have foreclosed his second priority deed of trust and achieved and acquired that. It would have had him, he would have been required to pay off the first, or at least take title in his foreclosure to the lien of the first, which is the Washington.
So it's not standard in the industry that when you sell the property, you pay off the liens?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. Yeah. Many transactions are completed with liens in place. There may be adjustments to purchase price, so forth. That would have happened here. If the argument that somehow or another this is a personal as opposed to property right to the Laundries were to prevail. Mr. Hicks's position is precisely the same today as it was when the original Hicks decision was and the original right of equitable subrogation was granted by this court to the Laundries. His position is exactly the same. He is subject to no other encumbrance. He's no other prior rights. He is subject only to the rights that come out of the Washington Mutual deed of trust and loan that was originally paid off in the original Laundrie transaction.
Mr. Hamill?
Yes, sir.
Now that you mentioned that, it seemed to me that your argument that he'll be unjustly enriched if you win, it seems to me that he is prejudiced, at least insofar as we follow Hicks 2, because of the increase in the principal and a new extended maturity date and that sort of, you know.
There is no prejudice.
Tell me why that's wrong.
Because what he is subject to is the Washington Mutual Deed of Trust. That Washington Mutual Deed of Trust has not changed one iota. The fact that there are other deeds of trust that have come into the chain of title is a matter of no consequence to Mr. Hicks. Because whoever has this right of equitable subrogation has only the rights that were afforded Washington Mutual.
So maybe you should explain exactly, because I think that's part of the question I had. What are you asking us? If you win specifically, numerically, what happens? What's the result of the practical result?
The practical result is this. There is a piece of property which is owned now by the June Depps that is subject to a deed of trust that was granted by the June Depps in order to pay off the Chase obligation, which in turn had paid off the Washington Mutual obligation.
Yeah, but that's in a higher amount, right?
It does not make any difference because we're dealing with issues of priority here.
Well, that's what I want you to explain.
The only priority to which Mr. Hicks is subject is the same priority as he was subject to during the original Laundrie decision by this court, and that is the terms and conditions of Washington Mutual. Whatever has happened since that is a matter of no consequence to Mr. Laundrie or Mr. Hicks. If he were to foreclose today, the deed of trust which would prime his position would be the Washington Mutual deed of trust.
In the amount of?
In the amount of the original $1.4 million approximately. Because that is the amount that we are subrogated to. We are not subrogated to some other amount. We are not senior to Mr. Hicks in some other amount. To the extent the city mortgage has a lien on the property, it is subordinate to Mr. Hicks's lien.
And what's the amount of the city mortgage?
The amount of the current city mortgage loan?
Approximately.
I do not know, Your Honor. I think it is...
It's greater than $1.4 million, right? Is that wrong?
No, 1.193 was the city mortgage lien. City mortgage and June Defs have a priority right together, a non-severable, non-divisible priority right pursuant to Hicks 2, the original case in this court, which granted the Laundrie's equitable subrogation. They are senior to the extent of whatever they could, whatever Washington Mutual could recover under its deed of trust. Anything above that, whether it's a lien in the way of a new mortgage or equity that's been put in by the June Defs or any of their successors in title, would be subordinate to Mr. Hicks's lien. So Mr. Hicks is in the position of being a second deed of trust holder, if you will, subordinate only to the original deed of trust to Washington Mutual.
So play this out for us, if you will. What if he decides to foreclose on his lien? What happens?
He's like any other second deed of trust holder.
So run us through the process. I'm not real familiar with it.
He would start in this case, this is a judgment lien, it would be a sheriff's foreclosure, but the procedures are the same as with public trustee. A notice of foreclosure, you go through a Rule 120 hearing, there would be a sale at which he bid whatever amount he chose to bid. If he prevailed and some subordinate lien did not redeem him out, then those subordinate liens, including in this case city mortgage, to the extent that it's not subrogated to Washington Mutual, would be cut off. If he is not redeemed out, then he takes title of the property subject to the Washington Mutual deed of trust. The original deed of trust to which now June Defs and city mortgage
would come first under your equitable subordination theory.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't.
Well, the Washington Mutual, that based on the new financing is what would be the priority. Right.
It's not based upon the new financing. It's based upon the fact that we are standing now in the shoes of Washington Mutual, just as if they had assigned us their deed of trust, which is precisely what this court held is the practical effect of equitable subrogation in the AmeriQuest case, which we had just not too many months ago. In that case, the court says that what happens when you have an equitable subrogation is that there is a revival of the discharge lien and an assignment by operation of law of that lien. Mr. Hicks argues in this case that, well, if we had just gone through the process of taking an assignment of that lien, the Washington Mutual lien, we would be golden. Nobody argues, nobody has ever argued in this case, that if the simple step of an assignment of that note and deed of trust had been made, the Washington Mutual note and deed of trust, to the Laundries and Chase at that point in time, and if the Laundries and Chase had then assigned that mortgage that had been assigned to them to the June Defs and City Mortgage, that we wouldn't even be here. Nobody argues that you cannot assign a deed of trust. You clearly can. And nobody argues that when you foreclose a junior deed of trust, such as the Hicks lien, that the senior deed of trust stays in place. Yet we have this perverse circumstance here where they're arguing that the June Defs are in a position where they must pay, notwithstanding the fact that they have paid off the Washington Mutual loan three steps down the way, they are deprived of the rights of equitable subrogation that this court has already found exist in the Laundries and its lender, City Mortgage.
Yeah, you're asking us to adopt position or the restatement that we haven't done before. I mean, why do we need to do that?
I'm not asking you to adopt the restatement. I think the restatement is a correct interpretation of the law. If you want my opinion on that, then we've argued that in our briefs.
Okay.
And I think this court came very close to saying we adopt the restatement 7.6. You don't need to do that. You never need to reach that issue, nor do you need to reach the third issue that's been certified by certiorari here. And that is, well, are the facts here such that the June defs are entitled to equitable subrogation? We are not arguing that the June defs are entitled to equitable subrogation. That would take a hearing of some sort to determine those issues under Hicks 2, the original subrogation case. What we've got here is a simple question of conveyancing. If I have equitable and legal title to a piece of property, can I convey that? And the simple answer has to be yes. The analysis under Avila is right on point. They argue that Avila has never been followed by any other court. It's never been rejected by any other court. We're dealing with a somewhat unusual circumstance here.
Could I interrupt for one moment, please? Because
sure.
Something you just said kind of in passing concerned me. You said you're not arguing that the June defs are entitled to equitable subrogation. But what you are arguing, obviously, is that they're entitled to derivative equitable subrogation.
It is not an issue in
so,
this case.
Please.
It's not an issue in this case from our viewpoint that the question of direct equitable subrogation exists.
Because, and implicitly you're saying, because that's already been decided with respect to the Laundries.
That property right is invested in the Laundries by this court. And what the argument that seems to be being made by Mr. Hicks here is that this is somehow or another, and in fact it's the argument that was adopted by the Court of Appeals, that somehow or another this is a personal right that is non-transferable.
I'm sorry, interrupting you one more time, if I may. So why is, when the Laundries sold their property to the June defs, you said they could easily have transferred this, maybe I misunderstood again what you said, this right of equitable subrogation, or signed, or made some sort of an assignment, and that the only issue here is that since they didn't do that, whether there is some sort of derivative equitable subrogation. Did I misunderstand what you said?
They did transfer.
Right.
That is deed. So what I said was that there has never been any argument that if originally Washington Mutual, rather than having its deed of trust released, had assigned that deed of trust to, at that time, the Laundries and Chase.
Okay, so
the question, that would have been valid, and nobody would have argued that.
Okay, so I did misunderstand that a little bit. Well, then, so they did assign their rights, all rights, which you say include equitable subrogation.
The Laundries conveyed by absolute warranty of title, or by absolute conveyance, all of their rights, equitable and legal. By the way, let me point out one thing, because there seems to be some confusion about the fact that they excluded from their warranty a title, this issue of the lien of Mr. Hicks. The conveyancing clause of the deed is very different from the warranty clause of the deed. Conveyancing clause, by both the statute and by the language of this deed, conveyed all of their right, title, and interest in the property, everything they had. The argument here is that somehow or another, this equitable subrogation right that has been bestowed upon the Laundries and Chase by this court is somehow or another personal. That is where the unjust enrichment to Mr. Hicks comes in. It is not a personal right. It's no more personal than an equitable easement or a right of adverse possession or any other kind of equitable claim that the grantor of a piece of property may have. He transfers those to the grantees unless there is an express reservation of some property right. Clearly there was not here. Then both under the statute that we've cited and under the language of the deed itself, which is not mere boilerplate, but rather language clearly setting forth the intention of the grantors, all of those rights were transferred. If we do not hold that to be the case, then there is in fact a very significant unjust enrichment to Mr. Hicks. Because if Mr. Hicks' lien somehow or another then is promoted to first priority, where it has been put in second priority to the WAMU, Washington Mutual lien, then he gets the priority of money that ultimately will accrue to this property. Either the Laundries have to pay that off, thereby diminishing the estate that has been awarded to them by this court, or they suffer a diminution in their purchase price because the June defs are going to say, well, we have to pay that off, so instead of paying you $1.9 million or whatever it is, we're going to pay you $1.9 million less whatever the Hicks lien is. And so the estate that you have given, awarded properly to the June defs, is now diminished. That imposes such an impediment.
To the June defs or to the Laundries, the estate that we awarded in the first case to the Laundries is now diminished if we take the Court of Appeals position with respect to the June defs.
That's correct.
Yes, all right.
I may have misspoken.
Well, I just want to make sure.
It's the Laundries.
I have a little cheat sheet in front of me with all the names and the transactions, so I want to make sure I'm following that precisely.
The June Depps are the sellers to the Laundries, right?
Excuse me, Your Honor.
The June Depps are the sellers?
No, just the other way around.
The other way around.
Okay, thank you.
The original.
Laundry sold to June Depps.
I don't have Justice Rice's organizational.
Well, I have a little cheat sheet.
I need one, too.
Yeah.
The original sale was to the June Depps, the Laundries, the Laundries then to the June Depps.
Thank you.
And those are really the key transactions here.
Okay.
Because when the Laundries obtained title, this court said you have not only the title that you got, but you're equitably segregated to Washington Gulf.
So does this case boil down to a determination of whether this our case granting equitable segregation to the Laundries, whether that right, that whatever that is personal or not?
That was the turning issue in the Court of Appeals.
Mm-hmm.
They seemed to say that, yes, there was an award of the right of equitable segregation to the Laundries, but that was personal to them only between the Laundries and Hicks. I do not understand the logic of that.
Okay.
Because once you take that position, you have now extracted from the Laundries estate the amount of the Hicks lien. Or you have put such an impediment upon their ability to convey the property that it's an improper restraint on alienation. It's important to remember, and I go back to reinforce this issue. Mr. Hicks today is in exactly the same position as he was 5 years ago when the original Hicks versus Laundry case was decided by this court. And so if he is elevated to priority above the June Depps and City Mortgage, then that is an unjust enrichment.
Can I just ask you a question going back to your previous thought about whether it's personal or not? Is an equitable right personal?
It has personal aspects to it, but when it involves the right to property.
Since one has to make, in making an equitable an award, one has to take in the equities vis-a-vis that person versus whoever else the person is that you're ruling upon.
And, you know, it's,
please.
Let me quote from the Court of Appeals, if I might, because this is something about the Court of Appeals decision that I frankly have not been able to understand.
Okay.
Court of Appeals on page 9 in their decision say, in our view, a judgment awarding such equitable relief, that is, the relief to the Laundries, establishes the priority positions between those litigants and thereafter has the same legal effect as a priority granted under the Recording Act. I read that to mean that what happens is that once this equitable right is established, then it is as if that deed, the original mortgage had been assigned. The Washington Mutual mortgage had been assigned. That's the teaching of the AmeriQuest case. We are standing in the shoes of Washington Mutual. Because that lien has priority over the Hicks lien, it passes just as if we had taken an actual assignment from Washington Mutual instead of one by equity. And again, the language in AmeriQuest is that it revives that lien and as a matter of law assigns that lien to the Laundries. And so that lien is in existence. There's no impact on the Recording Act. There's no impact on Mr. capacity to enforce his lien. If he's got a valid lien, we don't think he does, but that's been ruled upon. If he's got a valid lien, he can enforce that lien, but it is subject to the rights of those who are subrogated to the interests of Washington Mutual.
And the June Depps could sell it under your theory to anybody. It could just, that equitable subrogation right, which is, could be passed down, could be transferred to.
Just as much as an easement or a right of occupancy of some other sort or some other equitable interest that they have. Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
It is a part of their, we call it the bundle of sticks.
Sure.
From the law school, but that is part of their bundle of sticks. They have legal rights, they have some equitable rights, they have other rights that are all property rights. But to diminish those property rights by granting Mr. Hicks the priority that he would like to have in this case destroys that bundle of sticks, at least a part of that bundle of sticks, and imposes a restraint on alienation which is inappropriate, improper.
Mr. Hamilton?
Yes.
The Bar Association, in their amicus brief, says that your, what you just argued for would turn real estate law on its head. I wonder if you could address that.
I do not understand that argument. Nobody, as I've said before, contests the fact that if Washington Mutual had actually put on record an assignment of its deed of trust to the Laundries, let's just make it simple, to the Laundries, that that assignment would be fine. Nobody would have any objection to that. It's part of the chain of title. Because the laundry's right is acquired by the decision of this court, which puts it in that same position as the legal assignee, the assumed assignee as a matter of law, then what it has to do is protect its interests under the recording statute by recording some indication of its right of subrogation. In fact, the Laundries did that. Now, the June debts, if they are entitled to the right of subrogation emanating from the Laundries, need to protect their rights as a matter of interest, as a matter of record. There's nothing in this transaction that is unique. The only thing that is unique here is that there was not an actual assignment of the deed of trust. There was only an assignment as a matter of law by this court's ruling in Hicks 2. And so I don't understand how this turns the idea of law upside down. What you have is an assigned mortgage. You're standing in the shoes of that priority holder. And that is true in hundreds and thousands of transactions all the time. And that's nothing new in the property laws.
Well, they say that once a senior lien is paid off or released, the junior lien moves up one notch, which, of course, didn't happen here.
That's right. The senior lien has never been paid off. That's the point. That was the equitable subrogation. The WAM, Washington Mutual lien, is still in place.
Well, then that is the fatal flaw in the CBA brief, is that it?
I think it is the fatal flaw in the CBA brief, because it assumes that there somehow or another has been an extinguishment of the Washington Mutual priority, which is simply not the case. We have not increased our priority. The fact that there's a new loan for $8 million wouldn't increase our priority over Mr. Hicks. The only priority we have is the priority that emanates from our role or our position as being the assignee as a matter of law under Ameriquest and Hicks 2. Assignee as a matter of law of the rights of Washington Mutual. And so whatever we have done with that property, by encumbering it further or whatever, makes no difference, because our position with respect to Mr. Hicks is that we are prior to him to the extent of $1.42 million and whatever else is owed under that original Washington Mutual lien. That's all. And that's where Mr. Hicks was when he recorded.
What did you mean when you said that Mr. Hicks may not have a valid lien? I didn't understand that was an issue.
It's not an issue, Your Honor.
Okay.
We have taken the position that is not before this court.
So we're going to ignore that.
You're going to ignore that.
Well, you lost that in the past. I mean,
we've lost that.
Yeah, so we're starting at a different place.
Let's assume he's got a valid lien. I mean,
so Mr. Hicks is still number two, and it doesn't matter really what happens.
He's still number two, but he's only number two to Washington Mutual,
right,
where he has always been. In fact, if you want to look at it, his position has actually improved from the time that he recorded his lien, because there were two other deeds of trust, if you recall the record, from Hicks. And so his position is actually enhanced by what we have done. It is certainly not in any way prejudiced. And this whole idea that, you know, that we've got a longer term, the language from Hicks 2, where the court said, well, if there had been a change in the deed of trust, a different interest rate, a longer period of time, so forth, he would have been prejudiced. That's absolutely true. And that is why the rule of law is, as clearly enunciated in Ameriquest, that our priority position is limited only to that priority position of Washington Mutual. We are standing in the shoes of Washington Mutual.
So in other words, if for example, the city mortgage was twice what it is, it would only be to the extent of the first mortgage, the WAMU mortgage, right?
If we're in a position where we are standing in the shoes of Washington Mutual, we can't foreclose the Washington Mutual law, the deed of trust. Mr. Hicks is in the position of a second priority holder. He can redeem from that foreclosure. If he does not redeem from that foreclosure, his right is cut off under the foreclosure statute, the judicial execution statute, if you will, in this case. So he's exactly the same position as he was before. In fact, as this court noted in the original Hicks decision, that if this lien had even been known at the time of the closing, this closing probably never would have taken place, because there was no equity in this property. Mr. Hicks was in a position where he had no equity behind three deeds of trust. He's now at least got equity in only behind one deed of trust for an amount actually less than the original amount of that deed of trust. The fact that we paid that off at a discount does not enhance our position. We only step into the position of the $1.4 million plus that we paid off. If the amount of that Washington Mutual loan was $1.7 million originally, then our restriction right is still $1.4 million. So that's our priority, that's his second priority, and none of this stuff about equity stripping or anything else has anything to do with it, any more than any circumstance where if I owned a house with a first deed of trust, a second deed of trust on it, and I sold it at a profit without paying either the first or the second deed of trust, that's my money, that's my profit. My second lien holder, Mr. Hicks in this case, has no interest whatsoever in that property except as a lien holder. Statute says that in Colorado. We have a statute that says this is a lien state.
Could I ask one question about the, when you talked about standing in the shoes of the earlier lender, American Mutual, does it make a difference whether we're talking about the lender here or the owner in terms of who stands in the shoes of the prior lender?
The argument has been made in the past that there is some sort of a division of this right of subrogation. Under the original Hicks case, where this court held that there was a right of subrogation in Laundrie and its lender, City Mortgage, that was a single right of subrogation. There's a lot of argument that there was in the Court of Appeals about merger of title. There is no merger of title issue here, and the reason there isn't is because if you had a merger of title issue here, there would never be an equitable subrogation of this type. It is true that many instances, perhaps even most instances, the concept of equitable subrogation is the dispute between two lenders without the owner being involved at all. In this case, this court has determined that both Mr. Laundrie and his wife and City Mortgage were entitled to a unitary right of subrogation. The argument that was made in the Court of Appeals was that, well, how can I be as a title holder to a piece of property, in this case, the Laundrie, or the Jundas, how can the Jundas be in a position where they've got a deed of trust and the right to foreclose against themselves? They have an assigned right of deed of trust. There is no merger. If there were a concept of merger, then this court could never have granted the kind of equitable subrogation it granted, because it would have said, okay, Laundrie and City Mortgage, you are equitably subrogated, but by the way, there's now been a merger of title, so therefore there's no subrogation. That kind of circularity destroys the whole concept of the subrogation that's already been granted in this case. So if there were to be a circumstance where the Jundas and their lender now wanted to foreclose this assigned deed of trust, they could do so. And that may be what they will do. The issue is here one of priorities. It is not one of merger of title. It's not one of equity stripping. It's not one of anything other than, is it permissible to assign, to transfer a right of equitable subrogation? Avila is smack on point. It is well reasoned. And when you look at it in the application of this case, if it is not applied here, then either the Jundas or the Laundries are deprived of a very significant amount of value to their property. And Mr. Hicks is suddenly in a position, having not relied on the recording statute, having been involved in what I think could reasonably be said to be inequitable conduct at the outset, is now suddenly elevated to a first priority position for which he has paid nothing and which he is trying to collect against people who do not owe him one nickel. Why doesn't he go and collect against Mr. Grubbs? That's the one who owes him the money. All he's trying to do is game this system. And he's doing it in a way that these are technical arguments that have no substance. And if applied, would deprive the Jundas, or the Laundries, depending on which way you want to slice it, of about $600,000 or $700,000 worth of value in this property. There is nothing in Hicks 2 that permits that. There's nothing in logic that permits that. Avila is square on point, and I recommend it to the court as being something that you should consider and follow in this somewhat unique circumstance.
Counsel, I'm sorry, I have to slip in one last question. As I listen to you, it sounds like you're putting all of your eggs into the derivative equitable subrogation basket. Is that correct? I mean, if we find that there is no such thing as derivative equitable subrogation, do you lose?
No, I think what would have to happen would be, if you say, well, should we evaluate whether the Jundas now are entitled to equitable subrogation, Jundas and their lender, we'd have to have a hearing on that to establish the facts. There's nothing in this record that I think would permit this court to say there is no equitable, direct equitable subrogation available to the Jundas or to their lender.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Frederick Skillern, appearing on behalf of the appellee Don Hicks, the respondent. With me at council table is Max Stitch, who assisted on the briefs. This is a difficult subject to talk about, isn't it?
Well, it's a great shock to find out the Colorado Bar Association is wrong.
Yes, well...
And to follow the bouncing ball, if that's what you mean.
Well, frankly, the arguments here are so off the realm, so out of the mainstream. Not only has derivative subrogation not been adopted by any state court in the country, only referred to in that one Third Circuit decision, which has never been followed by any other federal court on that point or any other state court. This is off the map in terms of radical, and that's why the Bar Association can't even figure out where this is coming from. But we are right. They're putting all their eggs in the one basket of derivative subrogation. They have admitted for the first time now that they would lose flat out on direct equitable subrogation. We briefed that in summary judgment. They introduced no evidence in response. Hicks is prejudiced because he's behind bigger liens. He's been delayed by at least 4 to 6 years in recovery of this phantom 1.4, behind the 1.4. He's prejudiced in a lot of ways. The city mortgage is negligent, all that. But what it really comes, so they're putting all their eggs in the...
Well, just a second. I don't think that's quite what they're saying. All they're saying is that if this is not a derivative equitable subrogation, then there would have to be a determination for the June deaths, just like there was for the laundries, whether there was an equitable subrogation. So I see the issue as whether or not you can transfer an equitable right, an equitable subrogation right.
Okay.
Is that not right? Is that not the issue?
Oh, I think that is the issue.
Okay. So we don't need to worry about these other things.
Well, we'll talk about it in a minute, because I think in Hicks v. Lundre, you put out a nice decision. It comprehensively covered equitable subrogation. We've been following it to the T, and now we say the rules have changed. Now we're talking about something else. But let's focus on the derivative subrogation, because it's unique. It's never been adopted by any other court, especially in favor of a buyer of real estate. Okay. And so let's talk about it. The fallacy underlying their claim is, what is this equitable subrogation interest they're talking about? I will agree with Mr. Hamill in his brief to this extent, that the equitable subrogation right they have is essentially an equitable lien on the property. And the reason why this case is so novel and really will almost never repeat itself, it's a very rare fact situation, which is, again, why it's hard to talk about. But it involves Mr. Lundre, after the application of equitable subrogation, having an equitable lien on his own property for the amount of his down payment of $400,000. Now, usually, yes, we talk about merger. You can't have a lien on your own property. But in this case, the court clearly intended Mr. Lundre to have an equitable lien on his own property for $400,000. Chase had a legal lien, but they shared the priority of Washington Mutual senior status to the tune of $1.4 million. The fallacy here is they are counting the mortgagee's interest, Chase, who had $1 million mortgage, as their own equitable right that then they can transfer by deed to Dr. Junedef. And they count the mortgage just twice. The questions were excellent. They admit here for the first time that City Mortgage is junior to our judgment lien. That's common sense, because under the Recording Act, it is junior. But they are then, and they're saying that's a lien that remains on the property that's junior to Hicks. But the Junedefs received $1.4 million plus interest, and I want to talk about that, because they don't mention that. They assiduously avoid that. They argued it in the trial court. But they're saying that the Junedefs have $1.4 million equitable interest when they only paid $700 or $800 down payment. They're saying that Lundre, after this case, had $1.4 million equitable interest that he could transfer to Junedef, even though Lundre's equity in the property was only $400,000. And that's what it really comes down to. If you're trying to put any intelligible intellectual construct on this, that the party, that the public can follow in the future.
Well, but let me just interrupt and ask you this.
Please.
Laundry did have something, $400,000, $1,400,000, whatever numbers, okay?
Yes.
So what you're saying is that the equitable interest that was granted to Laundry was limited to a certain amount?
Yes.
All right, and that he can only, but you are agreeing that he can transfer that equitable interest, or are you? Let me ask you this. Are you asking that he can transfer that equitable, let's say the amount is X, so we don't get too worried about numbers. So he had equitable interest X. Can he transfer equitable interest X to the Junduffs or Junduffs, and they now have a derivative equitable subrogation interest X?
X. I don't agree with that.
All right. So we don't really need to worry about the numbers. They don't get to transfer X. Is that right?
They may or may not. It's a question of intent in any case.
Well, that's my problem. I mean, if they were only able to transfer X and that's now worth Y, I could understand we're worried about the difference between Y minus X. But if they can't transfer X at all, then what are you saying exactly, please?
If X is an equitable lien that they had for $427,000, that lien was paid. Mr. Laundry at closing got his $427,000 back, got an additional $500,000. The judgment lien that was validly on the property was ignored. This all happened. So that's it. The lien was paid. You can't pass on a lien when that lien has been paid.
Is no equitable subrogation interest anymore.
Pardon me?
There isn't an equitable subrogation interest, so there can't be a derivative equitable subrogation interest as a result of the sale.
I think that's right, but if there is an equitable subrogation interest, and I don't want to confuse you, but
if you are, though.
Well, there is. It was either paid or it wasn't, okay? If it's a lien right, and if it wasn't paid, if they actually intended to assign it and not consider it paid, and that's a twist you can put on the facts. If they did, the right that the Laundries had was limited to $427,000.
Okay, well, how do we know, though, whether it was paid or assigned?
Well, we look at the closing sheets.
Why is it a twist on the facts? Why is that still a question?
Pardon me?
Why is that, as you said, a twist on the facts? Why is that a question? I mean, why don't we know that?
Well, they were paid. I mean, they got $900,000 at closing. They had a lien of $424,000. Under any other circumstances, that lien would be considered to be going away. If you look at the deeds, there was no intent, there was no mention in the contract or the deeds or anything of any, say, here, Mr. Junduff, Dr. Junduff, we are giving you our equitable subrogation right. That was silent on the transaction. These are arguments made up after the fact to try to protect the title insurance company's interest here, quite frankly. The lien, I think it's important to get back to that initial question. What is the equitable subrogation right we're talking about here? It was a shared, I mean, if you look at the last line of Hicks 2, this court said that that Laundry and Chase, who had a $1 million right, together go into the senior lien position of Washington Mutual. Chase had 1 million of that 1.4 equitable lien. Laundry had 400,000. That's what makes this case complicated, but it is not an unusual factor in commerce for people to share a lien. But the fact of the matter is, Chase had $1 million of that million, and that was paid off very clearly at the closing in 2005 on the sale to Junduff. It was required to be paid off and the deed of trust canceled by the title insurance commitment in the matter. Chase did. They got their money and they released their deed of trust. Chase never assigned its equitable right to Laundry, so then Laundry could in turn assign the 1 million part of that equitable lien to Junduff by warranty deed. So what I'm saying is, and it's very important, that if you see a valid intellectual construct that the Laundry equitable lien was not paid when he took $900,000 out of the property in 2005. If it was transferred to Junduff, it would be limited to Laundry's actual equity in the property. His equitable interest is what we think of as our equity, $427,000. When Mr. Laundry bought this property in 2002, the subject of our first case, he paid $400,000 some down, had a $1 million mortgage. He thought his equity in the property at that point was $427,000. And if he had a lien for that amount is what he can transfer, if anything, to the next buyer. In Ameriquest, the two points were made very clear. A, you cannot acquire an equitable interest in an amount greater than what you paid for that equitable interest. And you cannot have a subrogated lien position that is greater than the gross sum that you paid off. Landre cannot have an equitable lien on his own property under this court's first decision greater than the amount that he put on the table, $427,000. Chase's lien priority would be based on its actual mortgage, but would have the fictional, the subrogated lien priority going back to Washington Mutual. And that's fair and that makes sense. Chase was paid. Landre, we submit, was paid, but if he had any equitable lien right to transfer, he could only transfer what he owned. And he did not own his mortgagee's rights. It just, as an owner of a property, we can't do anything to affect our own mortgagee's rights, and we certainly can't transfer our mortgagee's rights to somebody else. That's a separate and independent lien on the property.
So why doesn't your client just step forward and foreclose the lien?
We've done that twice. We started the foreclosure first time, and it took three years to get to the Colorado Supreme Court. And then we didn't know at the time of the argument in the Colorado Supreme Court that the property had already been sold to June Deff. This court didn't know that. And we could have saved 4 years had those facts come forward at the time. But be that as it may, we're back here 4 years later. The moment we did find out the property had been sued, we started a foreclosure action.
Okay. So that's what this case is.
And here we are.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. And here we are. But it's very important, and I think what you got was not a complete answer, Justice Bender, when you said, what are the numbers? If Mr. Hicks forecloses, what is he behind? The number should be $427,000 at best, we'd say. It should be $1,427,000 if you want to look at the whole Washington Mutual loan. But what concerns us deeply, and this could be the grounds for a third round trip back up here, and I pray that it doesn't, is that they are claiming that the Washington Mutual lien position is accruing interest at 8% annually since 2002. That puts it up over, way over $2 million right now. And so they're saying the Washington Mutual rights that they can enforce, because no payments have been made to Washington Mutual, keeps going up. Meanwhile, they're paying off their own separate mortgages and doing business on the side. So when they come down to the trial court, they're going to be saying that that Washington Mutual lien interest is bears interest and is now $2 million. That is why it's prejudicial, and that's why Mr. Hicks would not be, under their theory of the facts, in the same position that we are today.
Well, Judge Skillern, Mr. Hamill pointed out that that in Hicks 2, that we made no distinction between the rights of the Landres and Chase. Specifically, we said that they're entitled to step into the first lien position.
That's correct.
So it seems to me that runs counter to splitting the interest between the positions of the mortgagor and mortgagee, which is what your argument essentially is.
The logic fails me that Landre can afford that. Landre owns that whole $1,000,004 equitable right, because if he did, if the Landre's equitable subrogation right after this court's decision in Hicks 2 was $1,000,004, and if Chase still had $1 million mortgage on the property, then Hicks is behind $2.4 million, and that would have been real prejudice. You can't stack the loans like that. If Chase walked out of this court in junior lien position to Hicks, that's not what this court said in Hicks 2, and it would have been news to them, because they thought they came out of this in a first lien position for the amount of their mortgage. Their mortgage is not owned by the Landres. What Landre, sure, he has fee simple title, and he's got a bundle of sticks. They say because he still has the Hicks lien on the property, he can't convey his full bundle of sticks. But that's really that misreads what this is. The equitable subrogation right is not an estate. It doesn't diminish the fee simple estate. it's only a lien, it's only an encumbrance upon the state, and it's not a part of the bundle of sticks whatsoever. I can't see that there is what I'm struggling for, Your Honor, is some intellectual way to say that Landre has the ability to assign his mortgage company's lien to somebody else. All Chase wanted was to get paid. They got paid $959,000. That is how much. That's why if you add interest to the Washington Mutual, this is so fundamentally unfair, because that Chase loan had been paid down to $959,000, and at best, any derivative of that should be limited to $959,000, because that's what was paid to release the Chase loan in the 2005 closing.
You're going to have to clarify for me, if you will, how this argument that we heard prior to yours is covering the title company's original mistake and missing the lien.
Well, a good question, a good point was made earlier. It said, well, how would this, and I think it was raised by you, Justice Hobbs, is this ordinary? How does this sort of thing happen? What would ordinarily happen in 2005 is if they saw a first mortgage of $1 million and a second mortgage of $427,000 and then the Hicks judgment lien, the first thing a title company would do closing the sale to the June Defs would be to call up everybody and get a payoff. And they would call up Hicks and said, what do we have to do to get rid of your lien? That's what would happen in the ordinary course. That didn't happen here. No phone call ever came to Hicks. Hicks was oblivious to the whole thing.
Because the title company missed it.
Well, the title company didn't miss it in 2005. They had missed it before. Right. They were getting sued by Landre in a bad faith action because the title insurance company didn't pay off Hicks. And so what they did, and this is the point in Landre's affidavit, what they then did is said, okay, tell you what, Landre, we'll let you sell the property and take all your profits, and we'll just indemnify the buyers, June Def and City Mortgage, that they won't suffer any harm, and we'll go on from there. And so that's why the only party with any money on the table here is not the June Defs. They won't suffer a penny of a loss. They have the indemnity from Older Public Title, who engineered that closing. When we went to the closing in 2005, the buyer knew of the Hicks lien, the seller knew of the Hicks lien, this court, the Court of Appeals at least, had ruled that the Hicks lien was valid. Everybody knew of it, but they just did a deal. They said, okay, we're not saying that you're going to be in first position. You're taking the property subject to the Hicks lien. And that's exactly what the first lien letter and the title insurance commitment and all that says. They just say, we will endorse over that. We will insure over the Hicks lien and promise you won't suffer any harm from that. Under state insurance regulations, they can't do that unless they have separate money posted aside to cover that claim. So that's the real party in interest here, and that's really what's going on.
Well, and didn't you also state in your briefs that this sale had occurred before the case, what became Hicks 2 was argued?
Yes, it was.
But we decided the case without considering that, or probably without knowledge.
That's right, without knowledge and without considering. And when they say, is there prejudice? Well, we're 4 years down the line now, arguing about the same things we probably should have been talking about in 2005. Mm-hmm. And time is everything. Time is money. It's money from it, and to just say that Mr. Hicks, oh, he's just got a judgment lien. A judgment lien is, under Colorado law, repeated decisions this court, has all the rights of a bona fide value, is just as valuable a lien as any other lien. And granting derivative subrogation here in favor of City Mortgage or Landre, June Def, an amount that would cover City Mortgage's lien, would open up a firestorm, because then you would get every other mortgage company saying, well, we can just close every deal and ignore junior liens, because if you're just taking the position of a first lien holder, regardless of anything else, this won't be a decision limited to equitable subrogation. Every other first mortgage lender is going to be able to say, we can just ignore junior liens when property gets sold and life is good.
Mr. Scalone, could you explain to me the extent to which you agree or disagree with the analysis, not the result, but the analysis of the Court of Appeals? That is, could you compare your analysis of this to that of the Court of Appeals?
I think it's the same. I think that this is a novel legal theory.
So you fully support the analysis of the Court of Appeals, the manner in which they reached the conclusion?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Because it's fully consistent with the Recording Act. There are arguments that have been made throughout the briefs that Mr. Hicks is not intended to be protected by the Recording Act, that the Recording Act only, that Mr. Hicks would have had to have done something else subject to recording of his deed in order to have the protection of the Recording Act. That just simply misreads the Recording Act. The Recording Act gives lien priority to people who first record without knowledge of other interests, and that's exactly the position that Mr. Hicks is in. He should be in the position of a bona fide purchaser. He should have been paid at the closing of 2005. He would have been had it not been for the title insurance company's actions in indemnifying the purchaser and not notifying him of the sale. And that's it. What you really have here, fundamentally, going way back to 2002, was there was a mistake was made and Hicks's lien wasn't spotted. It wasn't picked up by the title company that did a search. The title company had insured the buyer and the new mortgage lender, all of whom we can submit. Laundrie at that point, Chase, were innocent parties. Hicks was an innocent party. You know, between all this, everybody says, what a shame it would have to be if Mr. Hicks got paid. Well, it wouldn't be a shame. Judgment should be paid. Judgment liens are valid. All Mr. Hicks is doing is enforcing the law as its course is written. And when senior liens are paid up, junior liens do move up in priority.
So this is a pretty peculiar, exotic case we've got here based on the fact that in the normal course of conduct here, these liens are called up and paid off.
Yes.
Originally, and that should have happened years ago.
Absolutely. Well, nobody knew about it in 2002, and that's understandable. That was a mistake, and that's where we came down in Hicks 2. Equity can come in to correct a mistake.
Right.
If no one is prejudiced. But it's hard to say, I submit, 7 years down the line that Mr. Hicks isn't prejudiced.
So are you saying that our Hicks decision was wrong?
Pardon me?
Are you saying that what we're calling Hicks 2 was wrong?
No, I'm not. I mean, Mr. Hicks argued against it. His arguments were valid. I wasn't counsel in the case. But what I'm saying is it's a well-reasoned opinion that presents rules that everyone can live by and limits subrogation as a limited exception to the Recording Act. The Recording Act is very, very important for the free flow of commerce and the stability of titles. That should go without saying. When you start adopting wide and liberal and broad exceptions to it and new doctrines like derivative subrogation, you're opening up a firestorm that will cause litigation, and this courts will be seeing more and more of it. And it will be very prejudicial to everybody who's a junior lien holder. And who are junior lien? Who are judgment lien creditors anyway? Victims of crime, victims of intentional torts, mechanic lienors, homeowner association liens, to just willy-nilly say that we can close transactions. And all we have to do is insure the new buyer and insure the new lender, and then we can just ignore all junior liens forever. And that's prejudicial, and it changes the law, because all of those people who have valid junior liens, be they the crime victims or the mechanic lienors or the homeowner association.
You couldn't insure around it if you knew of these liens. I mean, isn't that right? Isn't that what makes this case so unusual?
I think the law is you can insure around anything you want. You can promise something, but it's by endorsement, and you're indemnifying them. You're not telling them that the lien isn't there, but by insuring over them, you will someday pay that lien so it won't hurt the homeowner. And then if you add on to it the fact that we're really at a 1.4 Washington Mutual loan that is bearing interest at $8 million, like of a 10-ton gorilla, at 8% per annually for 8 years. Meanwhile, the real mortgage is being paid down and equity is actually growing in the property. That'll be a big change in the law.
So what actually was the bet that Old Republic was making then when it indemnified the June Defs?
Oh, the bet it made was that if it allowed the sale to go through and June Def to take his $800,000, $900,000 in profits, then that would minimize his damages against them in the bad faith action, which this court can look upon Lexis. The case settled about 9 months later. I have no clue what the settlement was. That's the bet they were doing. They're minimizing their losses.
But you're saying you meant laundry, didn't you? Not Joondalup.
Laundry, yes. This court did open up I would like to say something about the actual knowledge thing, because you said that if derivative subrogation doesn't apply, what should we do away with the actual knowledge requirement? This really wasn't argued by Mr. Hamill. I would just assert that the way this court phrased the requirements in Hicks versus Landre, was a middle ground approach, a sensible approach. You had black letter rules involving knowledge, negligence, sophistication that the courts have had no trouble adopting. We've had a number of decisions following Hicks 2, and to overrule the actual knowledge portion of that would be not called for by the facts of this case, and I don't think it would be good public policy. I would urge you to study, if you're tempted to, is to look at the portions of our briefs where we say that the actual knowledge requirement is really a requirement that subrogation is not granted absent some mistake, where the parties end up after a transaction having been mistakenly placed in a position they didn't know they were going to be in. The threat with doing away with actual knowledge requirement is that implies to people that regardless of any mistake, you can just ignore junior liens and claim senior priority because you're a first mortgage lender.
What about the Avila case Mr. Hamill wants us to rely on?
The Avila case, I think, misapplied New Jersey law. It is wrong in the sense that it sort of hints that the buyer there, the individual deemers in the position of the Joondalups here, somehow owns his own mortgagee's right. The Avila case, it was kind of like a not that big of a deal, because in that case, the subsequent sale was not for a greater amount of money, but was for a lesser amount of money. And so the Internal Revenue Service, the bad guy, who was in the position of Hicks in that case, was actually after that sale behind a smaller lien. And so subrogation really didn't hurt the Internal Revenue Service in that case because they were behind a smaller lien in any event. That's really my take on Avila. I think it's not supported by any other cases. No other court has ever mentioned the words derivative subrogation in the context of real estate financings or real estate sales, and I just think it was wrongly decided. The final point I would make is the Law Review article in the Brigham Young University Law Review by Nelson and Whitman, who are the reporters on the Restatement of Mortgages 7.6, has some very interesting languages in there. They actually refer to there's some comments in there that saying that applying equitable subrogation at all in the context of a sale is such as we did in Hicks 2, where a new buyer or a new buyer's mortgagee are equity subrogated, that's something that's rarely happened. They don't really endorse it. They call it radical. They say it's curious, but it just shows you and illustrates for you where we are on the outer edges of what the norms of the law are. And this sort of derivative subrogation is mentioned nowhere in the restatement of mortgages. Final point, there is the notion that Washington Mutual could have assigned its deed of trust at any point in time to other parties, and then they'd have all the rights, and Joondalups would have all the rights to assign that mortgage. Well, the Joondalups, if that had happened, would never have, or the Landres would not have ever acquired that note. It would have been Chase, and it would have been City Mortgage. But it would have required a number of things, as I pointed out in the brief, for City Mortgage to assign its mortgage and note. For Chase to assign its mortgage note to City Mortgage, that would involve a lot of things, such as the consent of Landre, which he would not give. He didn't want to remain liable on an active note. You can't transfer a mortgage after you've paid the note, because after you've paid the note, the mortgage is extinguished. Thank you so much. If there's no further questions.
the idea that this is a divided subrogation right is simply not supported in Hicks 2. It's not supported in Avila, and it's not supported by logic. And the reason it's not logical is because in the event of the Londres, they owed the money to Chase. Had they not paid, they would have been sued by Chase. And so when we talk about equity versus equitable lien, A, we don't have an equitable lien. We have an assigned lien by the operation of law. And B, equity in the sense of what we put on the table is not what it's issued. Because not only did the Londres have the money that they put on the table, they had the obligation to their own lender. Those funds together had paid off the Washington Mutual loan. There's a single right of subrogation. It is not divided. There are other comments I could make, but I see I'm out of time, and I apologize. Thank you.
On behalf of the court, I want to thank both counsel for your arguments today. The case is now submitted. The court will be adjourned.